Okay, so I'm going to start with a reading this morning, and I thought, well, you know, probably most of us to some degree or another are missing the presence of Lungpa Pasano. So I thought I'd start with a reading from one of his collection of talks, Don't Hold Back. And this is the one entitled Apanika Dhammas, and I thought it might be a useful one as a first day talk. So I'll just read it and it'll be self-explanatory as we go along. Then the general format here would be to do the reading and then have a brief time for anybody who has some questions about practice, whether it's related to this or another kind of practice or Dhamma related issue. But generally speaking, on the topic at hand, we can have a few minutes of that, but generally try and keep this to somewhere between half an hour and 45 minutes. In the van this morning on our way to Alms Round, we talked about the Apanika Dhammas. It was a fruitful discussion, so this is the theme I will address tonight. Apanika Dhammas are ways of practicing that the Buddha described as incontrovertible. By practicing them, we can be sure of being on the right path and that they will lead to awakening. These teachings are Indriya Sangwara, restraint of the senses, Bhojane Matanyuta, moderation in eating, and Jagariyanu Yoga, devotion to wakefulness. Once we start working with the Apanika Dhammas, we begin to see how they highlight the challenging aspects of the mind, aspects associated with greed, hatred, and delusion. This is exactly why the Apanika Dhammas are such excellent practices to bring up for reflection and investigation when we are on retreat, and there are fewer distractions. The Apanika Dhammas, however, are not extreme or ascetic practices. It is all about balance, the middle way. These practices are based on skillful restraint and application of energy. We need to learn when to pull back and when to push forward. Ultimately, the Apanika Dhammas help free us from compulsive behaviors that lie at the root of suffering. Indriya Sangwara, restraint of the senses. Restraint of the senses is recognizing that all phenomena are just sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, and mental events, and that these arise and pass away. They arise and they cease. When seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, we maintain equanimity. This is the training. These are the instructions by the Buddha on how to develop restraint of the senses. A monk, on seeing a form with the eye, does not grasp at any theme or variations by which, if he were to dwell without restraint over the faculty of the eye, even unskillful qualities such as greed or distress might assail him. He practices with restraint. He guards the faculty of the eye. He achieves restraint with regard to the faculty of the eye. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an aroma with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on feeling a tactile sensation with the body, on cognizing an idea with the intellect. He does not grasp at any theme or variations by which, if he were to dwell without restraint over the faculty of the intellect, evil unskillful qualities such as greed or distress might assail him. He practices with restraint. He guards the faculty of the intellect. He achieves restraint with regard to the faculty of the intellect. This is how a monk guards the doors to his sense faculties. It's not so easy to sustain awareness and clarity of attention to be restrained in the senses, but these are ideal things to be doing. Having this kind of reflection of consistency of attention means that the mind doesn't get drawn into things to which we are attracted or find irritating or offensive, distracting or exciting. What is it that draws us into that sense of engagement, becoming, and being? What is it that draws us out of clear space and the clear space of awareness? It seems quite fundamental, a seemingly simple practice, just to have restraint of the senses. But the practice is much more than that. It starts to open up into more refined levels of the nature of mind. We begin to notice how the mind gets drawn in. By making these movements of mind conscious, we can see how the mind gets drawn into that which is unskillful, unwholesome, and associated with aspects of greed, hatred, delusion, liking, disliking, desire, and attachment. We see, wow, my mind just keeps moving there and getting drawn in. The practice of sense restraint highlights the mind that goes out, the mind that seeks rebirth, seeks becoming. We become the things that are interesting and exciting, but we also become the things that we dislike, are averse to, or are irritated by. That's a becoming as well. So this practice is a helpful mirror to see clearly what the mind tends to do and what it wants to become. Steadiness of attention in general helps strengthen the mind. Restraint of the senses helps us from becoming entangled in getting or becoming. It takes a resilient mind to resist the onslaught of one sense desire after another, to fight the forces of delusion. Skillful restraint frees us from mindlessly slipping into the grasping, deluded mind. We're able to see that sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, and mental formations are just that. All it is sense contact. The senses are not good, bad, or ours to own or control. Restraint of the senses helps us get a feel for the contented mind. As challenging as this practice is, restraint of the senses also yields powerful results. Steadiness of attention helps strengthen the mind. It cuts through the habit of getting caught by experiences that are irritating, offensive, distracting, or exciting. A steady mind is the gateway to seeing more refined levels of the mind, which is naturally content and free of sense desire. I encourage you to get familiar with and to learn the mechanics of what draws you out of that clear space of contentment and entangles you in becoming and getting. This practice is guaranteed to yield significant results. Bhojane Matanyuta, moderation in eating. Moderation in eating is a mirror of the mind with its attraction to tastes and flavors, the stream of desire that goes out, seeking that which is pleasurable and gratifying. The practice begins by cultivating an awareness of what the body actually needs, not what it wants based on excitement or boredom. What is within the bounds of keeping the body healthy, strong, and energetic? When we overeat, it saps energy and makes us a bit duller. It's important to keep a balance where we are neither eating so little that there's not enough energy, nor eating so much that the mind is heavy and slow. The Buddha experimented with extreme fasting and found that the extremes, austerity and indulgence, did not work. To end craving and dwell in contentment, we practice the middle way. As monastics, we can eat every day, but we keep it to a simple breakfast and the basic midday meal. Or, for those following the Dutanga practices, we eat just once a day. These are the Buddha's instructions on moderation in eating, which the monastics at Abhayagiri recite in English each day. Wisely reflecting, I use alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, for helping with the holy life. Thinking thus, I will allay hunger without overeating, so that I may continue to live blamelessly and at ease. That, by the way, that's from the Anguttara Fours. Pay attention to the relationship between the food you eat and the amount that keeps the mind bright and the body feeling light. If you've tired yourself out lugging a stomach full of food up the hill and your first thought at the door of your kuti is, I think I'll have a rest, then ask, well, where's that desire coming from? The tiredness that can arise after eating the midday meal usually comes from overeating. In this case, just eat less. Ajahn Chah was quite proud of the fact that Wat Pa Pong was renowned for being one of the monasteries with the worst food. As a monk, that certainly made it hard to get caught up in the enthusiasm to overeat. In that sense, the worst food was the best training. On one pra, Ajahn Chah would deliberately make sure all of the small alms food offerings were mixed together into one big pot. Fish, chicken, pork, curries, rice, noodles, desserts, and beverages, so that all the flavors were mixed together and nothing was distinguishable. Try that sometime and see what it does to your craving for food beyond what you need for energy and well-being. It's an interesting practice. We're quite fortunate at Abhayagiri. We're exceedingly well looked after. Yet there's also a downside to having an abundance of tasty and beautifully prepared alms food. It requires much more attention, restraint, and responsibility. There are all sorts of opportunities for the mind to stream out in search of pleasure and gratification. So be mindful and ask yourself, am I eating moderately? What amount is helpful for my practice? Am I just feeding desires and preferences, that insatiable hole that can't be filled anyway? Be attentive to all of this because there is more energy in practice when there are no worries or thoughts about food. There is a quality of being, a sense of nourishment, which is far more satisfying than physical food. It arises from within, when we don't engage in compulsive actions like mindless eating. We have the opportunity to experience a different kind of nourishment when we apply ourselves to practicing like this. Jagariyanu Yoga, devotion to wakefulness. The classic definition of devotion to wakefulness is practicing in the nighttime, which is divided into three watches. And how is a monk devoted to wakefulness? During the first watch of the night, sitting and pacing back and forth, he cleanses his mind of any qualities that would hold the mind in check. During the second watch of the night, reclining on his right side, he takes up the lion's posture, one foot placed on top of the other, mindful, alert, with his mind set on getting up either as soon as he awakens or at a particular time. During the last watch of the night, sitting and pacing back and forth, he cleanses his mind of any qualities that would hold the mind in check. This is how a monk is devoted to wakefulness. In Guttara 4. We incorporate this way of practice here at Abhayagiri. Ajahn Chah trained us in the same way. He would say, do not go to bed before 11 at night. Just keep alternating between walking and sitting meditation. Rest and sleep on the right side in the lion's posture between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m., but do so with the firm determination to get up and continue walking and sitting meditation. Ajahn Chah's instructions to practice continuously weren't based on a theory from the suttas or on a sentimental fable about the Buddha's teachings. Devoting energy and effort to wakefulness is what makes it possible for the mind to become clear and bright. Without unshakable devotion, awakening can't and won't evolve. The energy that we bring to practice and the amount of sleep we think we need are usually generated by different forms of desire and attachment. Vibhava tanha is generally connected with negation. Sleep is an easy way to annihilate ourselves and not have to deal with being alive or being ourselves. This is a common way to do that, and we can recognize that that is also suffering. When the mind brightens, we realize it doesn't need to have all of the props of sleep and rest that it demands. We see that when we bring wakefulness to the present moment, the mind brightens. There's a sense of well-being, and it's that kind of well-being that lays a foundation for meditation. There's a joyful quality, the opposite of vipava tanha, that sense of dullness and aversion. I don't want it to be this way. I can't deal with this. I don't want it. Living life this way is exhausting. Bringing the quality of wakefulness into the present isn't something we do at 11 at night. It's something that we bring into both the day and nighttime. When we wake up in the morning, there's a quality of alertness we bring into the moment, into the practice of sense restraint, into the things that we engage with. The cumulative effect of that devotion to wakefulness is that there tends to be less need for sleep. It's not that we crunch down and try to keep from sleeping. Rather, there's not the same need for sleep. There's more time available for meditation, reflection, and investigation. The mind has a buoyancy and a lightness to it. The mind is easily settled, easily concentrated, and stays with its meditation object. The meditation takes on much more steadiness. The mind becomes brighter when there's that consistency of wakefulness. We do not accomplish sense restraint by trying to keep our eyes down and ears plugged up. Moderation in eating isn't accomplished by forcing ourselves not to eat. Devotion to wakefulness is not a manifesto against sleep. The Apanika Dhammas involve the appreciation of the quality of being that arises when we are free from complications, that compulsion to get what we want through pursuing mindless eating or seeking annihilation in sleep. It comes from applying ourselves to the practice in a very positive way. The buoyancy of the mind comes also from a consistency of wholesome mental states, kusala dhammas, arising in the heart. Ordinary activities take on a quality of luminosity, as do objects of meditation. We are not trying to force the mind into a cramped and constricted box we consider, quote, meditation, unquote. We're just allowing the mind to open into that opportunity for luminosity and expansiveness that we realize is there all the time. We have this extraordinary opportunity to practice the Buddha's teachings in our life. It is a great gift. All of the circumstances and conditions during the time of the winter retreat are facilitating and supporting our practice. There is nothing holding us back from cultivating the qualities of faith and devotion. We have examples of the Sangha, both in the Buddha's time and in the 2,500 years of the teachings that were passed on. We have examples of the Dhamma being realized by many beings. Recollect that we are able to participate in and be part of this. The opportunity is there for us to realize the teachings. Where do our nagging doubts come from? What is our lack of confidence based on? How valid are any of these? Such doubts may seem very valid, but we can still set them aside and put our attention into the qualities of confidence and faith. It's a simple turning of the mind, and we realize that much of the teachings become clear when we're willing to do that. On a certain level, we'll never figure things out completely. We're not going to be able to logically think through every aspect of the teachings. Rather, as we apply them and put ourselves into the midst of the practice, they become clear. I will end as I began. The Upanika Dhammas are ways of practice the Buddha described as incontrovertible. They include Indriya Sangwara, restraint of the senses, Bhojane Matanyuta, moderation in eating, and Jagariyanu Yoga, devotion to wakefulness. By practicing them, we can be sure of being on the right path and that they will lead to awakening. They are very simple and basic practices, but they have many implications. Upanika Dhammas don't just illuminate habits that keep the mind ensnared by desire. They also give us the opportunity to restrain the mind and liberate the heart. So take these fundamental practices and make excellent use of them. I offer that for reflection this evening.
Another translation of that word is a safe bet. I think that's Ajahn Jeff. Upanika?
Oh, upanika. Safe bet.
I think that's did about gambling.
Yeah.
A safe bet.
They're hard to deny that they can be effective. Sometimes some of them may sound a little bit on the extreme level, like I suspect there's a few people who are wondering about 4 hours of sleep. this is a time of retreat, and it's a time to maybe kind of test some of our assumptions. Hopefully it's a time where activities are also a bit more subdued. Mental activity takes up a lot of chi, a lot of energy, and so if we kind of are able to lessen that through, lack of computers, lack of conversation, those kinds of things, to the extent that we can, there should be just naturally some more energy, and maybe to challenge the usual sleeping patterns. If you've been sleeping 6 or 7 hours, to automatically cut it to 4 or 3.5 or whatever might be a bit of a challenge. But if you feel inclined, go ahead and try. If that's too much, try shaving off a half an hour, shaving off 45 minutes, shaving off an hour, just to test the limits. See what your assumptions are based on. Give it a little bit of a challenge. See if the energy levels change. And you won't know in just one day. Give it a little bit of a time to see what happens. Or the eating, if you're only eating 1 or 1.5 meals a day, the tendency sometimes is to overdo it. But there is a certain lightness that really comes, particularly in the afternoon. We're going to have afternoon practice periods, so it's a good time to experiment with just maybe cutting out just a little bit to give a sense of buoyancy and lightness at that afternoon period. So these are things to experiment with. Winter retreat's a good time to do that. Restraining the senses. Just watching where the mind goes, what the mind wants to do, if it's starting to feel bored. So just noting and working with these is a great way to start the retreat. It serves as a setting of a basis for clarity, alertness, and a lightness of mind. Okay, well, if there's no other comments or questions, then we'll have a practice period from now until 9:30, I guess. And then 9:30 to 10:30, another one. So we'll each take turns ringing the bell. I'll start out ringing the bell today. If I'm in the hall, I'll ring the bell in the hall. If I'm outside, I'll ring the bell outside, and that's the way we generally do it for those who haven't been here before. So if you're outside and the bell ringer is inside, you just have to kind of watch the clock if you want to come in.